Shalom. Welcome to the third CD or tape or whatever you're listening to. In our discussion on the on creation and evolution, we are also talking about the relationship of evolution and organic evolution and what I call theological evolution. In other words, the evolving of doctrine and so forth, and the leaving behind of the old ways, the old practices, the old paths, see, and so forth. And man has evolved into the modern Christian religion that we have today, understanding that the antiquated Jewish religion has fallen off, the appendages of that, which would be the Sabbaths and the dietary laws and the festivals and so forth, in the same way that certain appendages in man no longer needed, and man's ancestors and so forth in the past dropped those off and developed new ones, and it went through the evolutionary process. And we're doing some of those comparisons. Right now, we were talking about macroevolution. When we left the last time, macroevolution, once again, being major upward changes in kind. In other words, coming up with a completely different kind that doesn't look like or resemble what it came from. That's basically what evolution is teaching us. And I'm going to suggest to you that theologically, the Sabbath has morphed and evolved into the Sunday concept, and that the Passover evolved into Easter, and Sukkot became Christmas, and unclean things now are all of a sudden clean things, and Torah, of course, turned into no Torah, and so forth. And these same processes have taken place in our modern religious thinking as well. Now, these things weren't created in a vacuum, and they didn't begin in the 1500s, and it didn't happen in the early part of last century. It started, I believe, with the early church fathers in the beginning, a subject that we have talked many times before in past series. But just as an example, let me give you a few quotes from the early church fathers, just two or three, in which they seem to follow this pattern. Listen very carefully to what they say based on what we've been talking about with evolution. In the letters of Ignatius in the second century AD, here's what it says, and I quote, "If then those who had lived in antiquated practices," of course that would be primordial soup ponds and apes, "if they came to newness of hope, no longer keeping the Sabbath, but living in accordance with the Lord's day," that would be the modern man, the modern Christian, "therefore, having become his disciples, let us learn to live in accordance with Christianity. It is utterly absurd to profess Jesus Christ and to practice Judaism." Hey, come on. These are the things with our ancestors, the monkeys and the tadpoles and so forth. All right? That's our ancestors. We're modern man now. We do these modern things. Oh, yeah, we all have the same common ancestor. But for some reason, the information that is in our our ancestors has produced something new, has gone through an evolutionary process. When the truth is, and I don't know if you can, you can't see what I'm doing here, but the bottom line is, back to the genetics things real quick. This is an important thing, but I don't want to dwell on it. If I had a frog in my left hand, and I had a bird in my right hand, and if I had a belief system that says this frog became this bird, just pretend that I also have the Feast of the Lord in my left hand, and, you know, Christmas and Easter and so on and so forth in my right hand. But just understand these things as I go through the bird and the frog. The truth is, according to what we know scientifically, by taking a microscope and looking inside of cells and molecules and so forth, and seeing the genetic structure of man and DNA and proteins and electrons and protons and so on and so forth, with that knowledge, we know that the reason why a frog produces another frog is because in the genetic structure of the frog is the information to produce a frog. It's called information, genetic information. When we look inside the genes of a frog, we see only the information to produce frogs. We call that frog information. Bird information cannot come from frog information. The information already has to be there. Now, if we looked inside of a frog and we saw genetic information for feathers and a beak, then we can know scientifically that it's possible that that frog could produce something with feathers or something with a beak or something with both. But you cannot get bird information out of frog information, you see? And the same is true with the feast and festivals that Christianity observes, which look nothing like, in other words, the genetic information for Christmas and Easter is not in the Passover, okay? It's not in the Passover and it's not in Sukkot. The genetic information for no Torah is not in Torah. So it can't produce that. It can't come from that. It has to be a totally new entity having nothing to do with what was previously there. So it cannot claim to have the same ancestor. It cannot happen that way. The genetic information for unclean food is not found, the genetic information for food is not found in unclean things. So nothing evolved and morphed into that. Now, the truth is, and we're going to talk about this in a little detail pretty soon, I said to you earlier that mutations can produce something new. Mutations. So technically, if Christianity has a common ancestor with the Jewish people or with Israel, okay, here we go mixing those two up again. If they do have a common ancestor, then the only way that the church can come forth from Israel is if there's been a mutation take place. Christianity or the church would have to be a mutation. And of course, the other interesting thing about mutations is that mutations produce downward and not upward. Remember when we talked about the adversary earlier, about his desire to ascend into the heavens, but actually he will be brought down to the pit. God is showing that contrast here. This is what you desire to do, but in actuality, you're going the other way. And so that's why they're called mutations. And many times mutations produce something that ends up being sterile. Such as a horse and a donkey produce a mule. And then from that point forward, mules can't produce any more mules. That's as far as it goes. Diseases such as multiple sclerosis and cystic fibrosis and things like that. These are mutations. These are not right. As sad as they are not right. And they produce something that's downward, not an upward evolutionary product. Now, another quote from Tertullian. In his answer to the Jews, he says, "It follows accordingly that insofar as the abolition of carnal circumcision and of the old law," of course that would be tadpoles and triceratops, "is demonstrated," that would be the fossil record, "as having been consummated at its specific times," that would be the emergence of Neanderthal and Cro-Magnon, "so also the observance of the Sabbath," that would be the gill slips, "is demonstrated to have been temporary." Another example, the Epistle of Ignatius to the Antiochians. Listen to what he says. "These things," this is a quote, "these things I write unto you, you new olive tree of Christ." I guess whoever wrote this, Ignatius, never read Romans chapter 11. I guess skipped over that part in class or something, you know, a whole new tree. Okay. I guess he missed that part. But anyway, then he goes on to say, "Beware of those," speaking of what proceeded before them with Israel and Jews and so forth. He says, "Beware of those dumb dogs." You know, they're further down the food chain. "Those trailing serpents, those scaly dragons, those ass, those basilisk, those scorpions, for these are subtle wolves and apes that mimic the appearance of man." Now, there's many other quotes in the early church father. Maybe I shouldn't use many. There's a couple of other quotes. I don't want to exaggerate here. Used by the early church fathers that also refer to the Jews as apes, as monkeys, if you will. Way down the rung in the evolutionary ladders and so forth. Now, as I said earlier, that's macroevolution. And I believe that's what Christianity teaches, that all of a sudden we've got Israel. And then all of a sudden in Acts chapter 2, spontaneously generated out of nothing, pops up the church and looks nothing like, you know, has cast away all these appendages that it had before. Now it's doing the whole new thing. I hope you can clearly begin to see that truth. However, Microevolution is true, is biblical, is scientific, and that is smaller changes within a kind. We would call that horizontal changes. We talked about different breeds of dogs, for example, and how butterflies operate. Evolutionists used to believe that butterflies was an example of evolution, caterpillar becoming a butterfly. Unfortunately, they had to bag that and get rid of that idea because as they observed this over the decades, they saw that caterpillars always turned into butterflies. Okay. And they never did turn into another species or another kind. Okay. So they could clearly see that this was just a microevolutionary process. That a caterpillar goes through and becomes a butterfly in frogs and so on and so forth. Now, we have also different ways, for example, of observing kinds theologically as well, with Sabbath being a kind, I'm going to suggest. We have different ways of observing Sabbath. If you go to different places around the world, you'll see people observing Sabbath in slightly different variations within a kind. But what are they all doing? They're still all observing the Sabbath. Okay, changes and variations within the dog, but they're still all dogs. There's variations in which we observe Passover and Sukkot across the world, but we're still observing Passover and Sukkot. There's different ways people tie tzitzit, okay? But they're still all tying tzitzit, even if they have different ways of doing it. That's variations within a kind. Now, as I said before, natural selection and the survival of the fittest is good science, the ability of variations within a kind to adapt to their environment. God would, of course, known that in advance, that those who are able to adapt to their environment will survive. Do you think it's possible that God knew that in advance and prepared his people to be able to survive and give them the tools to do it? That is the information that would be Torah to be able to do that. I think so. Now, one of the things we also want to talk about is design. I mean, design, if you can't look out into the world and see the absolute intricate, detailed design, I'm talking about the fact that evolution used to call things in the beginning as simple cells. Well, there's no such thing as a simple cell. There's no such thing as simple organisms. They're all very complex from beginning to the greatest, from the least to the greatest. They're all extremely complex, not just in human life, but looking at a snowflake, the design of a petal of a flower and so forth, and looking into the molecules that make up anything in life is extremely complex and would be incapable of producing life if it wasn't designed perfectly and exactly the way it was. Any changes causes, like I said, mutations and death and destruction. And we're going to talk about that more if we ever get to the anthropic principle, which I promise we will. Now, it was very detailed, complex design in everything that we see. There's design in the heavens. As a matter of fact, you'll find out that if you look deep into the heavens, and then you take with a telescope deep, I mean, into space, and then you turn around and took a microscope and look deep inside a cell, you would think that you were looking at the same thing, because the structure of our cells inside our body is just a little miniature universe inside of those cells. So there's universal design. There's design certainly in our solar system with the planets and the ecological design that we have on the planet, the way everything has a symbiotic relationship one with the other. There's biologic design in our cells and so forth. What does design assume? Design assumes a designer. Even something as simple as a bacterial flagellum, which we won't go into, I won't bother to explain what that is right now, but looking into the tiniest little arms that extend forth from bacterial cells and so forth, we look inside of those things and we see that it has all kinds of bushings and rings, and it has universal joints, and it has propellers, and it has rotors and a drive shaft, and it has studs and a C-ring and so forth. You see all this complicated stuff in the midst of just looking at some of the most simplest things, the human mind, and the cellular design and so forth, genetic design, atomic design, and subatomic design is everywhere. As a matter of fact, if I can quote from Michael Denton, a scientist by the name of Michael Denton, when he talks about the cell and DNA, here's the way he puts it, and I quote. He says, although the tiniest bacterial cells are incredibly small, each is in effect a veritable micro-miniaturized factory containing thousands of exquisitely designed pieces of intricate molecular machinery made up of 100 billion atoms. Far more complicated than any machine built by man and absolutely without parallel in the non-living world. This simple cell turns out to be a miniaturized city of unparalleled complexity and adaptive design, including automated assembly plants and processing units. And we're talking about a cell now, featuring robot machines and protein molecules with as many as 3,000 atoms in each in three-dimensional configurations. It's got manufacturing hundreds of thousands of specific types of products. This is only what science has discovered so far. Is this all by chance? Is this all without a designer? For true scientists have known for decades. They've known this for decades now. Only until recently have they been able to identify and model the zillions of sequences of coding required in the cell in order to have life. But, of course, they were previously unable to explain where the information comes from to perfectly line up these sequences. Now we know that there's such a thing as DNA, and that DNA was discovered to be the source or blueprint for this extremely complicated process. And we could go on and on with design in particular. Another example of design that I find fascinating, because it's my premise that if the effect, in other words, creation, is designed, then how much more, that's called Kaval Kamer in Hebrew, would the Torah that designed it, or the Word of God that designed it, how much more designed would it be? If it's designed, wouldn't the designer, the source of it, be designed as well? If like kind produces like kind. That's why I believe every individual Hebrew letter in the Hebrew alphabet has its own meaning, has its own numerical value, has its own purpose and individual design in and of itself. And every single letter is there for a reason and a purpose, because it is what created all the things that have perfect design. You cannot have the creation have design and that which created it not have absolute design. One of the wonderful examples of this is there's a man in 1175 AD by the name of Leonardo Fibonacci, which is Fibonacci. That'll also be in our bibliography. He was a European mathematician, lived in the 12th century, and he came up by looking at nature, by seeing flowers and the design of the petals and flowers. He was able to come up with what is called the Fibonacci number series. In other words, he created a mathematical equation. If you remember that Pythagoras, living several hundred years before the Messiah, even though Pythagoras had some crazy Greek ideas as well, nonetheless, he was right. He was a very great mathematician. And he's the one that said hundreds of years before Christ that numbers are the language of the world. Numbers are the language of the world. We see numbers in everything. Do you know that your computer operates by numbers? That's how you can see what you're seeing on your screen if you have a computer right now. It's all based upon a binary number system that takes place in your computer. And I think we've talked about that before. So anyway, he lines up these flowers and he discovers there's a pattern, a distinct pattern in the arrangement of the amount of petals and flowers. He also realized that this number system answered how rabbit populations expand and so on and so forth. So he would line up. For instance, he would line up lilies and irises, and then he put buttercups next to that, and then some delphiniums. I don't know what a delphinium is. My wife probably knows. Next to that, and some marigolds next to that, some asters and some daisies and so forth. And he noticed in flowers and pine cones and even the shapes of seashells that the numerical pattern was this: 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8. 13, 21, 34, 55, 89. I'll stop there. Now, if you wrote those numbers down, or you backed it up and wrote them down just now, you'll notice that the pattern is simply this. The number you're looking at is the product of the addition of the two numbers before it. So whatever number you look at in this sequence, it is the result of the addition, the adding together of the two previous numbers. So the first number is 1. Okay, now what are the two numbers before that? Okay, well, there isn't any two numbers before that. So you start with 1. The next number is 1. What's the two numbers before it? A 0 and a 1. 0 and 1 equals 1, so you got 1 and 1. The next number is 2. What's the two numbers before that? 1 and 1. 1 and 1 is 2. The next number is 3. What's the two numbers before it? 1 and 2, that equals 3. Then you got 5, which is 2 and 3. Then you got 8, which is 3 and 5. And you got 13, which is 5 and 8. And it goes in a sequence like that. And it's called the Fibonacci number system. And so when he lines up irises and lilies, he sees that they have 3 petals. Next to it is buttercups. They have 5. Delphiniums have 8. What is 8? When you add the lilies and buttercups together, the 3 and the 5, you get the delphiniums. Then you have the marigolds next to it, the corn marigolds. They have 13. What's that? The combination of the 5 and the 8 of the delphiniums and the 2 before it. The asters have 21. The daisies have combinations of 34, 55, and 89 in perfect sequence. In other words, design. Design. My premise is simply, could the words used to create all this be designed as well? Now let's go on moving along quickly. We still got a lot of more information to go. Man and ape, according to evolution, share a common ancestor. I'm going to suggest to you that the church looks at this the same way. It looks at itself as modern man and Israel as the ancestral apes that have evolved. And that we both do share a common God. Now, Christianity does teach that it does share some of the commandments, such as the moral ones. If you ask a Christian theologian, they'll tell you, well, yeah, we believe that you shouldn't kill and you shouldn't steal, the moral commandments we believe that Christ maintained. Now, in evolution, that sort of concept, in other words, they have a relationship because they share some common characteristics. This is called homology in evolution, H-O-M-O-L-O-G-Y, homology. Homology basically believes this, that man shares a common ancestor with the apes because man has an elbow and apes have an elbow. And because man has an elbow and apes have an elbow, in other words, they share some common characteristics, that means they both must come from the same place. They both must share a common ancestor because they both have elbows. Okay. Well, the same is true theologically many times in our doctrine as well. Now, I happen to believe that the way that liberals and conservatives view the Constitution today is also the difference between Hebrew thinking and Greek thinking and between evolutionary thinking, creation thinking. Conservatives, I'm not going to say all conservatives do, okay? But conservatives look at the Constitution as a fundamental doctrine, fundamental, unchangeable doctrine that was brought forth at a point in time, okay, being the fathers of our country. There's a time when it was brought forth. In other words, it didn't evolve, that the Constitution is not a document that's evolving. They don't believe that it's a living, breathing document that must change with the times. They believe that it is a fundamental doctrine such as Torah. Okay, so our country looks at the Constitution, if you think from a conservative, I'm going to suggest a creationary point of view, as a fundamental doctrine, document that transcends time, okay? That 100 years from now, we'll still be living by the Constitution. However, liberal thinking, which I believe is in tune with much Christian thinking, and if you want the relationship between Christianity, Christian doctrine, that is, and liberalism, you can go on my website, and I've got several articles dealing with that. That the fossil record has man evolving over millions of years and has the Constitution evolving in the last 200 years. Creation once again believes that the fossil record was laid down in an instant. That would be the flood in 2900 BC, laid down in an instant. And what we see in the fossils is what we still see today. And that the Constitution remains constant and transcends changing habits, times, and trends. And as I said, the evolution takes place over a fuzzy past over billions of years. Okay, another thing I want to talk about is what's called the geologic column. The geologic column. Now, The geologic column is basically the Bible of evolution. I mean, it's what they totally depend upon. Now, my wife is degreed, Carol is degreed in anthropology and geology. She was raised as an evolutionist. She believed fervently. Now, she believed in God, too, but she was one of those people that thought, well, evolution can fit into the whole God thing, okay? But she realized after study of the scriptures, she's realized she's one of the most ardent defenders of creation now. That you'll find, because she has the anthropological and geological background. She's very familiar with the geologic column, and she knows that the geologic column is the basis for the evolutionary thinking process. It is their Bible. The geologic column is a supposed column in which fossils of early simple organisms should be buried near the bottom of it. Intermediate forms would be found in a progressive order, eventually reaching to the more modern, complex, evolved species at the higher strata. It's a column made up of different ages, and I'm going to describe it in detail here in a minute, that goes from a Precambrian age up to basically the age that we're living in now. And it's presented as if you went anywhere in the world and you see these columns everywhere. The truth is, no such column exists in the world. Now, there are certain chunks of it, if I can use that word, scattered throughout here and there all over the earth, but the column does not exist. It's something that simply does not exist, and that's going to be important to see in a minute. It's just in their mind, in their imagination, but it drives everything that they believe in. Now, this column basically has been taught, is not found anywhere in the world, like I said. As a matter of fact, evolutionist Derek Ager, A-G-E-R, stated, this is an evolutionist, so listen to what he said. He said, "We are only kidding ourselves if we think that we have anything like a complete succession for any part of the stratigraphical column in any place. We're kidding ourselves if we think that." And of course, he's absolutely right. Now, the geologic column basically goes like this. It's a series of ages, okay, starting at the beginning, billions of years ago, in what they have determined to be the Precambrian age, or the Precambrian age, which would be, in their view, before 540 million years ago, okay? And that would be before 540 million years ago, there was basically just ancient amoebas and naked masses of protoplasm and chemicals gurgling and bubbling up in primordial soup ponds. And of course, rocks, you know, and things like that. So, you know, that's what you've got up to this point. After all those billions of years, things just kind of, chemicals just kind of sitting and bubbling and so forth until a bolt of lightning came down from the sky and gave it energy. And then it began to produce life and began to split and double, you know, all that kind of stuff. And that was before 540 million years ago. And then they have what's called the Cambrian Age, which would be, which they've dated from 505 to 540 million years ago. And here you have the primitive horseshoe crabs and simple-celled creatures and things like that occurring and that. And then you go through these other ages, the Carboniferous Age. As a matter of fact, they divided the geologic column is divided up into ages and epochs and periods, okay? So when we get to the age of the Carboniferous and Devonian and Permian ages, we're actually in the Paleozoic period. Okay, so they got these things all divided up and so forth and sectioned off, and only certain things were in these certain ages or certain stratas in certain layers. And then when you get up to about 245 million years ago, you've got the Triassic and the Jurassic Age. Now, of course, now we have the dinosaurs, okay? A lot of the cold-blooded animals and so forth and reptiles in this age. And then when you begin to... of course, when you find certain things in these stratas, they've already determined how old they are. So then you know, depending upon which strata, which layer you find things in, that determines how old it is, okay? And so if you see it in the Permian strata, then you know that it's 286 million years old. Well, how do they know it's 286 million years old? Because they found it in the Permian strata. It's kind of same kind of circular logic that they judge fossils, how old a fossil is, Okay. It determines where, what strata you found the fossil in. Okay. And there's just circular reasoning all the time. Well, the same is true with this geologic column. And then when you get up to about 66 million years old, up into the Pliocene and the Eocene ages, now you have the warm-blooded animals coming into view, okay? And you have rodents and things of that nature. And this is called the tertiary epoch, they call this. It's the Cenozoic age or period. We're in the Cenozoic period. And when we get up to the Pliocene age, now we're getting into the larger mammals. We're about 1.5 to 2 million years old now. Now we're getting, you know, into elephants and bears and things like that. And so, you know, how do you know that the elephants and bears come from 1.6 million years ago? Because you found them in the Pliocene strata. Okay. Now remember, there's no such complete columns, like there's just chunks everywhere. There's no columns like this anywhere in the world. Okay. So they don't have any reason whatsoever to judge like this. Now, when you get to the Pleistocene or the Pleistocene age, then you have the humans. Now that would be less than 1.6 million years old. We now have the humans coming into view. So as you can see, what we have is at the bottom in the Precambrian age, we have these, you know, like I said, the amoebas and so forth, and the chemicals and the pond and so forth. And then you get to the Cambrian age, and then you have the more simple, or at least what they, there's no such thing as a simple organism, but that's what they call it, the simple creatures and so forth, evolving into the more complicated as you get to the top. So according to this geologic column, it makes sense that simple things would be at the bottom and more complex things at the top. And if that is true, then that is good evidence that things have evolved. The problem is that's not true. The problem is we go to some of the tallest mountains in the world, Mount Ararat and Mount Everest and so forth. And what do we see at the top of those mountains? We see many of these creatures and primitive creatures and so forth that were, and horseshoe crabs that we're supposed to see at the bottom, we see up at the top. And many times we see the things that are supposed to be up the top, we see them buried in the middle, in the intermediate stages, and so forth. And so what we see when we actually look out there and we use empirical science, what we see is these various organisms, simple to complex, jumbled up all over the place, as if a cataclysmic, catastrophic event possibly took place, trapping these things all instantaneously, making fossils. Because you see, the whole idea of a fossil is a fossil cannot occur over billions of years. You can't have a creature, I don't care whether it's a spider, a frog, a lion, a horseshoe crab, or whatever. You can't have living matter crawling across on rocks and creeks and so forth, dying on the rock, and then being fossilized into the rock. Why is that? Because it would die. Either something would eat it, okay, or it would rot away. It would no longer be there. It can't sit on top of the rock for billions of years because within a few days or a few weeks or a few months, they would be gone. And so the whole idea that fossils are evidence of evolution is a humongous joke. The truth is, and that's something we can even do in laboratories today, the truth is if you take something like a horseshoe crab and you put it under extreme pressure, if you embed it in rock under extreme pressure, then you will have what's called a fossil. The evidence that we draw up from Earth is that something apparently happened to cause instantaneous pressure trapping materials in the earth between the rocks, you have complex creatures happening that way, large mammals and so forth, down to the most to the more simple creatures as well, and you find them in different layers and different ages in this so-called geologic column. Now, I think it's no coincidence that what we have been fed theologically, at least as long as I've been alive, is this whole idea of dispensationalism. Dispensationalism is part of the foundation and structure for many of the theological beliefs that we have today, the dominant one, or the one of the major ones, being that the Christ died to free, to end the law, because now we're in the age of grace and the age of all, the age of law has been done away with, and even the pre-tribulation rapture theory and so forth, all has its foundation on this dispensational thought process. Now, where do you think that dispensational thinking came from? I will remind you of what it is. In dispensational thinking, 4,000, 6,000 years ago at the time of creation, began the age, the strata, if you will, of innocence. In the garden when Adam was innocent, and there were certain conditions and things that only took place in that age. And then when Adam fell, that ended that age, and God started a new age and dealt with man differently. And that was called the age of moral responsibility, and that took place probably somewhere between 4000 BC, they say, and when Adam fell into the flood, which some people agree, I'm just going to use an average time of 2900 BC. Some say 3100. Someone say as late as 2450 and so forth. But I'm going with the 2900 medium view there. And that is the time when Adam was supposed to, or man was supposed to, react to God based upon his conscience or his moral responsibility. And of course, that was separate from innocence. And then when it came to the time of the flood in 2900 BC, then God began to deal a different way. When Noah came off the ark, he dealt with man in a different way. So in other words, instead of these things being exclusive rather than inclusive, rather than get God rolling out of scroll, we see him dealing with different ways in different periods. And from about 2900 BC to about the time of Abraham, God ruled by human government now. And then from 2150 BC to about 1450 BC would be the age of promise with Abraham. The age of promise with Abraham, in which God now dealt differently again. Then from 1450 BC to about 30 AD, we have the age of the law. Now God's going to deal with law, with the Jews, of course. Okay. And then when Messiah comes on the scene, we have the age of grace and the age of the church. And that's presented as being about 30 AD to the present. God's been dealing with grace and the church. But God, there's going to become a point where God's going to go back to the law thing. Okay. And that's going to be called the tribulation. Okay, now there's a question mark there, they would have, because obviously that hasn't happened yet. But there's going to be a time, since Israel seems to be around and the church is gone, and so therefore grace is gone, then we go back to the economy of the law again. Why? Because the Jews are back. Israel's back on the scene. We're back. And so here they are again. So now we got to go back just for this short period of time for 7 years. And we got to have the age of law returning for those 7 years. And then, of course, we have the seventh one, which is the age of the kingdom, which is also a question mark. That lasts for 1,000 years. And then finally, we have the question mark and eternity, which lasts in infinity. And so we have this pattern of dispensationalism, I believe, based upon this whole geologic column. This whole layers or stratus of progressive ways that God deals with man and so forth, and deals with him differently. And so that's why whatever God does in this age, we don't have to be accountable for it in the next age, because we've evolved theologically. Okay, we've gone past that. That's an appendage that we don't need anymore, because that was in that age and so forth. Now, I also want to go on and talk about a few minutes about the fossil record as well. Remember, I told you earlier that the fossil record is supposed to be this evidence of evolution and the progression. But I told you the reason why it doesn't work is because logically that's not what we see. And that's not what happens when we see things dying in the world right now. We don't see them making fossils. Okay. Because these things happen from a flood. But you see, many of the of the scientists, good, well-respected scientists, really don't see it that way either. And I want to give you a few quotes, beginning from some of those who believe in it and, of course, scientists who don't. Of course, once again, you and I are led to believe that all scientists believe in evolution. And, of course, that's absolutely not true. In his own book, The Origin of the Species, on page 163, here's what it says. But as by this theory, innumerable transitional forms must have existed, why do we not find them embedded in the countless numbers in the crust of the earth then? So he asks his own question. It sounds logical that these transitional forms must be in fossils. In other words, if you're going to go from a frog to a bird, then there has to be a species that have the characteristics of going from a frog to a bird. So why don't we see them in the fossil records? If we have gazillions of fossils, why don't we see any transitional forms? Scientists have been, or evolutionists, excuse me, have been looking for transitional forms ever since the late 1800s. They haven't found them, and Darwin wondered why they didn't see them all over the place either. In the book Conflicts Between Darwin and Paleontology, the Field Museum of Natural History writes in January 1979, and I only quote part of it. Here's what it says, and I quote, "Well, we are now about 120 years after Darwin, and the knowledge of the fossil record has been greatly expanded. We now have 250,000 fossil species, but the situation hasn't changed much. The record of evolution is still surprisingly jerky, and ironically, we have even fewer examples of evolutionary transition than we had in Darwin's time." For Pete's sake, Dr. Colin Patterson, who's the senior paleontologist at the British Museum of Natural History, was interviewed by Luther D. Sunderland as to why no evolutionary transitions were included in his own book entitled Evolution. This guy writes a book entitled Evolution. So we ask him, "I've read your book, and there's no mention of these things." And here's what he says. He says, quote, "I fully agree with your comments on the lack of direct illustration of evolutionary transitions in my book. If I knew of any, fossil or living, I would certainly have included them. You suggest that an artist should be asked to visualize such transformations, but where would we get the information from?" He said, "I could not honestly provide it, and if I were to leave it to artistic license, would that not mislead the reader?" Yet Gould and the American Museum people are hard to contradict when they say that there are no transitional fossils. As a paleontologist myself, I am much occupied with the philosophical problems of identifying ancestral forms in the fossil record. You say that I should at least show a photo of the fossil from which each type organism was derived? Well, I will lay it on the line. There is not one such fossil for which one could make a watertight argument. There isn't any, my friends. Once again, we're talking about arguing a truth from the absence of any evidence whatsoever. Just like there's no evidence in whatsoever in the scriptures that Messiah came to free us from the Torah. But we use that and we pass it on as if it is scripturally, and we base all of our theology on it when there's no evidence of it in, if you will, the theological record or the fossil record. Another example comes from a book called Temple and Mode and Evolution by George Simpson. He says, "This regular absence of transitional forms is not confined to mammals, but is an almost universal phenomena as long as it's been noted by paleontologists." In Stephen Gould's book, The Return of Hopeful Monsters, he says, "All paleontologists know that the fossil record contains precious little in the way of intermediate forms. Transitions between major groups are characteristically abrupt." In other words, they just appear on the scene. Oh, you're kidding me. Surprise, surprise. Okay, one more quote very quickly from Dr. Niles Eldridge, an invertebrate, a paleontologist at the American Museum of Natural History. His quote, I'll only do part of it here. He says, "But the smooth transition from one form of life to another, which is implied in the theory, that is of evolution, is not borne out by the facts. Gee, as scientists, shouldn't we be going by facts? As theologians, shouldn't we be going by all the evidence and not our presuppositions and biases? I would suggest the same is true there. Now, I talked earlier about mutations. Since the discovery of the genetic makeup of life, we know that if something changes, i.e. a tadpole to a bird, either through macro or microevolution, that in other words, even if either one of those is true, the previous species must contain the information for that change in order to produce something new. So where did the information come from if it was not previously there? Well, there is an answer, and this is true. The exception is mutations. However, mutations are always downward, as I said, and never upward. They never produce something better. They only produce something detrimental to the survival of that which it produces. And the same is true with humans as well. We have the same problem with humans. If we have a problem, whether it's Down syndrome or something else, the logical thing that we see is those who, now don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that Down syndrome people are mutations. I'm simply saying that when there's a problem genetically, okay, it's going to produce downward. That's just a reality that we have to live with. And the worst part about the reality is that those who are weaker are not going to be able to survive. They're very susceptible to diseases, and they have to be so carefully protected because of the nature of them being weaker, okay? And so it's logical that they just don't survive. However heartbreaking that is the reality, and that is the truth. Mutations, the genetic information, for example, of the church, this new entity that popped out from nowhere, would have to have been in that from whence it came. And so the information for all the things that the church does, okay, all its characteristics, all the things it believes and how it behaves and what it looks like and so on and so forth, would had to have been in the previous entity. The church admits that their roots are Hebrew roots. Most Christians I know would say that, okay? But what do they believe about that? Well, they believe that many of the things that are done before that have been done away with. And now we've taken on these new things and this new behavior, and this is how we look. Well, see, that totally contradicts what's going on naturally that we see in front of our very eyes. The information had to be there before in order for them to produce this kind of activity and behavior. Why? Because like kind produces like kind. The evolutionary argument that there were transitional forms based upon mutations still does not answer the fact that there are still no transitional forms, either way you look at it. As I said, genetic information has to already be present to produce something new. It already has to be there. So that means, according to 2 Corinthians 5:21, you are now a new creation in the Messiah. In the Messiah is the key. Okay? Nothing else has happened to your body. Your body is going to keep on producing like kind. But in order for the life of the Messiah to be in you now, the information that you have had to come from Him. Okay? That's why we are a new creation in the Messiah, because the Messiah is producing like kind after like kind by putting His seed, which is Him, His Word, in you, and now it can produce after itself. Now, that logically would be the same. If there's only one seed, then that would have to be the same as when that seed was planted in Abraham, in Isaiah, in Moses, in any of the Old Testament prophets and Old Testament people, because there's only one seed. Okay, unless you have a mutation, okay, and I would hardly think that we would call ourselves mutations, but what's happening is the Messiah is reproducing after Himself in you. The information has to come into you in order for a new creation to exist. Now, remember, spontaneous generation, life from non-life, has never been observed. Transitional forms have yet to be discovered, that is the fossil record. And for a while, as a matter of fact, a theory called punctuated equilibrium was the answer to this dilemma. Now, punctuated equilibrium is something that also Stephen Jay Gould, a noted evolutionist who has since passed away, also promoted. Punctuated equilibrium is just a fancy word for saying rapid evolutionary jumps. Remember we talked a while ago about the hopeful monster theory? Well, this is just a fancy way of promoting the hopeful monster theory. Since we can't find anything in between, then we're going to develop this theory that says it just came from nothing. Just jumped from a, as I said, from a bird to a reptile. Okay? And there are no transitional forms. Well, that makes it easy, huh? If there's nothing there and I can't explain it, then I just get rid of that whole thing and produce another silly argument. We just go from one absurd thing to another. Now, the other thing that that evolution does is they draw sweeping conclusions from little or no evidence. They come up with these fantastic conclusions and doctrines and theories, if you will, based upon either little or no evidence whatsoever, or they just make things up. They just come up with their own theories. Now, the evidence, the examples of that, of course, are the various. Remember the evolution of man, the ascent of man. If you can picture the Time magazine article in 1971, you can probably see it. At first, you've got the stooping monkey and so forth, and as he begins to walk upright in various stages, and his arms begin to get a little shorter, and they stop dragging on the ground, and his forehead stops protruding over, and it starts to be recessed and so forth, And at the very end of the picture, you've got a man with a suit holding a briefcase, right? And that's on the front cover. If you can picture the monkey stooped over in the first thing is the ancient primitive Jews, okay? And the guy with the suit and the briefcase is the modern Christian on the other end, if you can see this theologically. Then, for instance, but the truth is that they're drawing a conclusion from little or no evidence. The Nebraska, in other words, they have names for each one of these progressive entities going from monkey to man as well. And one they called Nebraska Man. Well, Nebraska Man was, some of these I heard before, I'm going to go through them very quickly. Nebraska Man, when we saw the evidence, turned out to be built upon one tooth. An entire man was put together from one tooth, a sweeping conclusion with little evidence there. And that tooth turned out to be a pig's tooth. It wasn't even a man. It wasn't even a human tooth. The Piltdown Man, of course, was a total hoax. It was totally made up. I mean, all the bones were painted to made to look old and so forth. And it was a total fabrication. Remember, people will go to great extremes in order to defend what they believe. Keep that in mind, just like football and baseball fans will do. Doesn't matter what your team does, how bad they are, whether they had a good season or a bad season, or even if half the team went out and pillaged the motel they were staying in and so forth, it doesn't matter. That's my team, and I'm going with it, right or wrong. And so then we had Peking Man, which is based upon the skulls of decapitated apes and so forth. And then you had Lucy, which is also called Australopithecus, which is put together from a jawbone and a knee joint, the famous knee joint and so forth, which they claim to be the transitional form between ape and man. And she was really nothing more than an ape. As a matter of fact, the knee joint that they put together with certain sections of the rest of her was found 1.5 miles away and 200 feet deeper than the rest of it. Now, Neanderthal and Cro-Magnon, of course, are just simply human. And so we find out that these things were based upon either no evidence, total fabrication, or a complete person put together with hair and facial features and so on and so forth, and walking upright and so forth, with just tiny little evidence, a little bone here and a little bone there. Remember I told you that in our museum here in Vernal, Utah, we get to look into the side of that face of that rock there, and we get to see what they actually found. And what they actually found was jumbled up because something possibly catastrophic must have happened. Okay. And they see this just mass of bones all over the place. But see, they won't show that on the inside. Okay. And in other words, they show something that looks like something that you could sit back and drink a cup of coffee and read your paper and hang around with the apes and the dinosaurs with on the inside. The same is true, I believe, theologically, that many of our modern theologians come up with sweeping conclusions upon Paul's statements. In other words, they don't know the background at all, with very little evidence. And very little knowledge of the background, they come to absurd conclusions. And they generally find what they're looking for. I mean, in other words, if they go into the New Testament with the thought that the Christ died to end the law, to free us from the law, then that's what they're going to find. They make their conclusion equal their premise. They will make the conclusion, they will design it to fit what they want to see. Because they don't know the background of these things, and they come to conclusions based upon very little evidence in the scripture. Why? The evidence in the background of everything that Paul says, as I said, is in Torah. It's in the creation. It's in the beginning. And that's why I will keep saying that until someone shoots me dead. Okay, now, we've come now to anthropic principle, something that I told you that we were going to talk about eventually. It's called the anthropic principle. Basically, the anthropic part comes from the Greek word anthropos, which is the Greek word for man or human. Okay, and the reason why they call this the anthropic principle is because the premise is that when we look at all the complexity of the universe, it becomes abundantly clear to those who believe in God. Okay. Now, again, you have to have a presupposition here. Okay. You have to have the presupposition is you already believe in God. And so when you see the evidence, all right, because we got to admit the same is true on both sides. When I look at the world, I look at a world with a preconceived bias that there is a God and a creator of all these things. So when I go out and enjoy Glacier National Park or Yellowstone National Park, I'm going out enjoying the product of a wonderful creator and the beauty of his creation. The science or the evolutionist goes out. See, I'm guilty of it too. The evolutionist goes out and sees a creation, although he considers it beautiful as well. You got to give him that. But he sees it as a series of things laid down over billions of years. And so when he looks at rocks and trees, he thinks back billions of years. Okay. The anthropic principle, however, I believe is so clear and contains so much abundant evidence that the universe was created and designed for man, for human beings. Now, see, remember the PETA people and some of the environmental people, they have evolutionary backgrounds to their teachings, okay? The PETA people, people for the ethical treatment of animals and environmentalists are part of their teaching and their thought process is that the humans are arrogant people, okay? And that not only are animals and spiders and so forth equal to humans, but they are actually more important than humans. So they consider the killing of the frog no different than the killing of a man and so forth. Now, the Torah that places the universe and earth in perfect balance also places his body or his people in perfect balance as well. Because what you're going to see when you see the anthropic principle is that everything's designed in perfect harmony and balance, and everything is just precisely where it should be, and that any movement for or against any movement, anything that adds to it or takes away from it, moves something closer or something farther away, destroys the balance of it, and life is not possible. So we see in the natural things, guided by the word of God, that they obey naturally and they're in perfect balance because they obey God. The same is true for God and his people, because the same Torah that created the heavens and the earth and the plants and the planets and the sun and the moon and so forth is the same Torah that created you and I. And so when we add or take away from God's word as it applies to us, we set the balance off. And so it's not Satan doing it to us. 99% of the time it's self-inflicted, because we're not applying the commandments of God to our lives, the same commandments that run the universe. And when you begin to see these things, you begin to appreciate the word of God and its perfection, absolute perfection. You change one thing and the balance is thrown off. You change the things that God told you to do for your life, given in his scriptures from the very beginning, and then you throw your balance off. And I'm going to suggest that's why there's death. What created death? Disobedience. God said not to eat something and they ate it. Isn't that interesting? Dietary laws are very much involved in what happened to the whole human race. And so we have sickness, we have disease, we have depression, we have violence and immorality. I'm going to suggest to you, because the balance is thrown off, and the balance is thrown off in our body. Okay. Now, Proverbs chapter 11, verse 1 says that a false balance is an abomination unto the Lord, but a just weight is his delight. I believe that God is very much involved with balance. In Deuteronomy chapter 13, verse 32, is one of three places where the Lord tells us, do not add to my word, do not diminish my word, because it's a matter of life and death. The same thing that destroys the creation is the same thing that destroys you, and that's from disobeying the words of God. Okay, so man is part of creation. God demonstrates to us through the harmful and sometimes fatal effects of ignoring or manipulating the natural laws how mankind experienced the harmful and fatal effects of ignoring his Torah. Now, I want to give you a few examples of the anthropic principle or genetic design. Okay. But let me begin with a quote. I think we'll talk about it now. Because I'm not going to be able to get into, at least not this tape series, to get into the details of our cellular structure and how DNA operates. I believe DNA is a picture of Torah, okay, given instructions to the protein molecules to go forth and create liver cells and pancreas cells and skin cells and so on and so forth, and that the instructions come forth from DNA. We don't have time to go into that, but I would like to bring up a very interesting verse in Psalm 139, verse 15. I'm going to start with verse 14. Go back to verse 13. Let's go back for some context here. Remember, in New Testament thinking, in Greek thinking, the context is, you know, the verse before and the verse after. Okay, never mind. Psalm 139, verse 13 says, "For thou hast possessed me, my inward parts. Thou hast covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are thy works, and that thy soul knoweth right well." Now remember, these things are going to be spoken by inspiration from a God who knows all the intimate details of our body and knows exactly how we are made. Now science is beginning to discover, true empirical science, that the source of our genetic structure is from instructions given in an entity called DNA, or deoxyribonucleic acid, and that's where our traits come from. And then in verse 15, he says, "My substance was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and intricately wrought in the lowest parts of the earth." Now, I believe your King James probably says curiously wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Now, that word for intricately wrought there, intricately wrought, is rakam in the Hebrew. Rakam. Now, before I define what rakam means in the Hebrew, I might mention that when you see the DNA, the structure of DNA, it is a double helix. It looks like a long two-stranded chain that's wrapped around itself. It's woven almost as these two strands that actually, if you stretch them out, even though DNA, believe me, is infinitesimally small, but if you stressed it out, it'd be extreme. You couldn't see it, but it'd be about 7 feet long, and it looks like a woven chain, a double helix, they call it. Now, it just so happens that the Hebrew word rakam is the Hebrew word for to weave, okay? To weave something. Now, remember, he says, my substance was not hidden from you, okay? I cannot see it. There's nothing I see, but it's not hidden from you, for I was intricately wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. I believe that could very well be a direct reference to how we, who we are and how we pass on our traits one to another. And it's through our individual, because it's different for every single person, our individual DNA. Now, let's go on and talk about some evidence of genetic design through the anthropic principle. The principle, once again, let me remind you, being that every single thing in the universe is there in a certain position, placed a certain length away from each other and so forth, and everything is just the way it should be. If anything was any bigger, any smaller, any larger, any farther away, any closer and so forth, life would be impossible or very difficult upon the earth, including the fact that if you even notice that even though there have been some meteors crash upon this earth, but if you look in a telescope and you see the moon, you see the other planets, you'll notice that the earth is placed in the exact proper position in the universe to protect us from the meteors. I'm going to suggest we're in the perfect place to protect us from the meteors. I believe that will happen until the latter days. I believe there will be an asteroid or a meteor that will strike this earth. In the book of Revelation, but that's because we have turned from the Torah and God has taken his hand off of us and he's not protecting us anymore. And that's another whole teaching. But for instance, the earth is precisely the distance it needs to be from the sun. If it was any closer, we would not survive. I'm talking about 1%. Okay, closer, we would not survive. It was 1% further away, we would freeze to death. We wouldn't survive either direction. So it's starting with principles like that scientists who know these things are true, okay, these things are not argued. It's just the conclusion to that, because evolutionists still refuse to believe that that's anything more than a coincidence, okay? We just happen to be the lucky ones. All right. As a matter of fact, you'll find a lot of evolutionists, a lot of Hollywood stars and people like that will say things like, well, why should we be so arrogant to think that we're the only ones in the universe? How many times have you heard that? You know, why should we be so arrogant to think that we're the only ones in the universe? They have evolutionary background to their thinking process because they don't believe that the Messiah and his body are the central focus of every aspect of creation from the very beginning. That's my premise here, my friends. Gravity is roughly 10 to the 39 power times weaker than electromagnetism. If gravity had been 10 to the 33rd times weaker, then the stars would be a billion times less massive and would burn a million times faster, for example. We talk about the nuclear weak force, which is 1,028 times the strength of gravity. Now, had the weak force been slightly weaker, then all the hydrogen in the universe would have turned to helium, making water impossible, for example. Of course, we know that hydrogen is involved with water. A stronger nuclear force, in other words, if it was stronger, even as little as 2%, then that would have prevented the formation of protons. That's kind of important, yielding a universe without atoms. Can you imagine a universe without atoms? If the difference in mass between a proton and a neutron were not exactly as it is, then the proton would be roughly twice the mass of an electron. Then all the neutrons would have become protons, or vice versa. So you can say goodbye to chemistry as we know it right there. And you can say goodbye to life. If the relationship of the mass of protons to neutrons, as what I'm trying to say, was not exactly the way it is right now, then neutrons would become protons and vice versa. And then chemistry would be totally out of whack. The very nature of water, which we know is so vital to life, is still, at this point, light and water. Isn't it interesting that the very first two things that we read about in the scriptures, light and water, are still the two things that science really doesn't know everything about and really still doesn't understand all the properties of it. For instance, I've mentioned before that science used to believe that that light was constant, 186,228 miles per second, or 186,282 miles per second, and then it was constant. But in the last 15 years, we've discovered, well, wait a minute, it's slowing down. It's not what we think it is. And we still don't understand all the properties of light and water. Something so vital to light, still a mystery to some people. Now, unique amongst the molecules, the water molecule is lighter in its solid form than it is in its liquid form, i.e. ice. Ice. Different from all other things in the universe. If water was not lighter in its solid form than it is in liquid form, in other words, ice floats, if it didn't, then the oceans would freeze from the bottom up instead of from the top down, and the earth would now be covered with solid ice. And of course, this has to do with the properties of the hydrogen atom and so on and so forth, but that's the beautiful evolutionary processes? I don't think so. By design, I think so. The same small changes in the universe and the ramifications are also seen in the structures of our cells, which I've talked about before. What we put in our bodies feeds those cells, okay? And so if we, according to the scriptures, if we don't do what God says to do, we corrupt ourselves. And I told you before, that is called, that is the Hebrew word shachat, a shin, a chet, and a tav, which based upon the meanings of the shin, the chet, and the tav, shachat means the sign of the destruction of the wall or fence. Okay. What's the sign of the destruction of the wall or fence? When we disobey God. Corruption and disobedience are always tied together in the scriptures. And so, once again, the same thing is going on out in the universe is the same thing that's going on in our cellular structure as well. We know that our sun is also the right mass. If it was larger, then its brightness would change too quickly and there would be too much high energy radiation. However, if it was smaller, the range of planetary distances able to support life would be too narrow, okay? And so we've got it also the right distance would be so close to the star that tidal forces would disrupt the planet's rotational period, and UV radiation would also be inadequate for photosynthesis. Okay, in other words, that, you know, there goes the plants and the flowers and so forth. The Earth's distance from the sun is crucial for stable water cycles. If it was too far away, most water would freeze. If it was too close, most water would boil. That's kind of a given as well. And this goes on and on. If the surface gravity was stronger, there would be no life. If it was weaker, there would be no life. If the distances from parent stars were any further away, then it would be too cool for warm, stable water cycles. Too close, too warm for those stable water cycles. If the thickness of the crust was any thicker, there'd be too much oxygen that would be transferred from the atmosphere to the crust. If it was thinner, then we would have volcanic activity would be too great. The rotation period is just perfect. It was any longer, no life. Any shorter, no life. The gravitational interaction with the moon, you know, if greater, then the tidal effects would be too severe. If it was less, then it would cause instabilities in our climate and so forth. If the magnetic field was any stronger, Then storms would be too severe if it was any weaker. No protection from wind particles, which would also, by the way, change the pressure up on the earth, the air pressure and so forth. And there'd be more there'd be less oxygen, not enough oxygen as well. I could go on and on, but the focus of the once again on the anthropic principle is that these things all work together in perfect harmony and balance, and the same Torah that controls that is the same Torah that was given to you and me. So can you imagine the creator of the universe taking up on the flesh of men and coming to earth to declare and to proclaim unto his new evolved people that he's going to die to free us from his Torah? That's all the time we have for this one. We have one more CD to go, and I'm going to talk about the what I believe are evidences for a young Earth and so forth. And then we're going to conclude with some more quotes from some evolutionists and so forth. And once again, I hope to give you more insight into the differences between evolution and science as well. In the meantime, cling to your roots that your days may be long and that you will prosper in everything you set your hand to do. See you later. Shalom aleichem.